very, very few investigators, even the ones, and I'm not kidding you, Tim, the ones oftentimes who really say, oh, what a shame, if only scientists would help. You get on the email or the phone and say, hey, I'll help. And if you want to see them convert into a mummy, that's the fastest way to do it.
Ladies and gentlemen!
One of the things you can do with the whole UFO situation all the way to abductions is maybe chip away at it. And if we can do nothing else, Tim, we can eliminate the stuff that just plain doesn't work. These are things that I find personally fascinating, and I can tell you that so do mainstream scientists. And we may disagree about, okay, whether there's any compelling evidence. But, man, you know, I'm if somebody calls me and they say, hey, there's a UFO out here, I'm out to look for it. And, you know, that's the way I'm going to be until I can't get up in the night and run around anymore. And I'm hoping that if we get enough eyeballs on the problem and enough real interaction that maybe we'll crack a few of these. And say, okay, yeah, we know what that one is now. Let's move on to the next one. Or, oh, this is really interesting.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. This installment of the program constitutes the first of the final four episodes here on Season 7, and it is an epic edition of the program. Based on our previous episode featuring skeptic Sharon Hill, BOA Audio continues our work building a bridge between the paranormal and scientific communities as we welcome Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, who is both a professor of microbiology at the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, as well as a keen observer of the esoteric and the esoteric research community. Chances are you've heard Dr. Tyler Kochjohn on a number of programs that are friends with BOA Audio, including Paratopia and Project Archivist. I connected with him following the Sharon Hill edition of the program, and after hearing my good friends talk about what a fantastic thinker he is, I decided it was time to bring him on BOA Audio to explore his thoughts on the world of the paranormal. And it is quite the exploration, folks. It is quite the conversation. This one clocks in at 3 hours total, a 3 hour long conversation with Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, and quite frankly, one that probably could have continued for several more hours. It is comprehensive, my friends, and really covers a myriad of paranormal and scientific genres. As such, it is a bit difficult to give you an overarching look at what we cover here in this marathon conversation, but here are some of the big talking points. We're going to discuss the challenges facing UFO and Bigfoot research, and the attempts to solve these mysteries to those in the mainstream science and academia. What steps need to be taken to truly break these stories open? And why has it taken so long to prove the veracity of these mysteries? We're going to explore those concepts here with Dr. Tyler Kochjohn. Additionally, we're going to delve into some hard scientific topics such as DNA, Alzheimer's disease, brain trauma, and the possible dangers surrounding the ubiquity of hand sanitizers and cell phones. Two things that you just simply cannot escape in today's modern society. Plus, of course, much, much more. I only scratched the very surface of this, as I said, marathon 3-hour conversation. Altogether, it is an epic edition of the program, which covers a wealth of topics in both the paranormal and scientific worlds, as well as where those two universes may overlap, with our guest, Dr. Tyler Kochjohn. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, please allow me to provide you with a little background on him. Dr. Tyler Kochjohn is a professor of microbiology at the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine and adjunct senior scientist at Banner Sun Health Research Institute. He has had a wide range of research experiences, beginning over 30 years ago with work on human tumor viruses. For the last 15 years, he has been associated with Dr. Alex Roher's group at Banner Health, investigating the underlying biochemical causes of Alzheimer's disease. That work has involved investigations into the aftermath of failed attempts to prevent AD by immunotherapy and the response of the brain to traumatic injury. He first became interested in UFOs after hearing Frank Edwards talking about his book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business, on TV early in 1967. He put those interests aside for decades, until reaching a point in his career where he could begin to examine and investigate UFOs and the paranormal, taking full advantage of his scientific training and experience. All he knows, for certain, is that there are few easy answers. Tyler can be found online at twitter.com/TylerKochjohn, and you spell that TylerKochjohn. Check it out. And with all that said, my friends, let's get down to business and rock and roll. This interview was recorded on March 18th, 2013. Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, talking about the paranormal and science on BOA Audio Season 7. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 7. And I have a feeling we're going to have a thrilling edition of the program for you folks because tonight's guest, he's really well thought of by a lot of people that I have a lot of respect for. The folks at Project Archivist, the folks at Paratopia, those four guys are like your biggest fans, Tyler. You wouldn't even believe it. I hear about you all the time. And I've wanted to have him on the show for a while because I've heard such great things about him, but our paths hadn't crossed until now. So I'm very excited to talk to him. He's really made a lot of appearances on various shows. He's spoken about the paranormal at length, but he's certainly not a paranormalist. He's a real live scientist. And he has a PhD in biochemistry from Loyola University in Chicago, and he's a professor of microbiology at the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine. And I am talking about the esteemed Dr. Tyler Kochjohn. And as I said, I've heard about you from so many of my good friends, and I said, we got to get Tyler Kochjohn on the show. We, like I said, our paths crossed, and it was time to do a Banal of America Audio. So welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on.
I guess, you know, we start out with the bio, the background. You know, who is Tyler Kochjohn, Dr. Tyler Kochjohn, and how did you end up getting mixed up in all this paranormal stuff? Because most folks in the world of academia, I guess it's really science, you know, you're doing real research. It's not just, you're not in the classroom. I don't know, maybe you are sometimes. You know, most folks like that don't want to get involved in all this. So, you know, you're kind of the white crow for all the black crows out there.
Well, it was kind of a long odyssey, and a lot of it was accidental. And before I had any kind of formal science training, I was interested in UFOs as a kid. And I watched television one day, and Frank Edwards was on, and he had a book out at the time in the late 1960s called Flying Saucers, Serious Business. And I had to get that. And then for a few years, I'd got everything I could get my hands on about UFOs.
You sound like me and most of the members of the audience.
Well, and it's just something that I don't know why, but at the time, I grew up in Northwest Iowa in the late 1960s. There were cattle mutilations, sightings, very exciting time for UFOs. Mm-hmm. And so lots of interest. Parents were talking about it. We were out looking for them, you know, everything you can think of. And some of my friends were actually trying to create them, which was interesting. Hot air balloons.
Like Brady Bunch style?
Yeah, you got it. Yeah,
wow.
So anyway, that, and then came the Condon Report, And that really kind of took the wind out of the sails for, I guess, the popular public interest, or it really, in my mind, began to change the whole character of what UFOs were perceived to be and how people viewed them. And I think I was talking to Jeff Ritzman saying that I got the message. If I wanted to proceed in science, I kind of knew what things to pursue and what things to drop.
Yeah.
And UFOs, I stopped following them for, oh my gosh, until James Corian, the former director of MUFON.
Oh, yeah.
Came out late 2007 and was saying, gosh, you know, what a shame more scientists aren't interested and won't help out. And I thought, you know, hey, I can do something. I'm a tenured professor now. You know, I've got some time I could spend and devote and not get into trouble. So I got in touch with him, and then the UFO Hunters show came on, if you remember that, on the History Channel, and that got me going. And then the next thing was Carol Rainey. And this may sound strange, but Carol Rainey was the first person, kind of what I would say high-profile investigator or someone involved in the field, who actually listened to me. Most other people, I think, took my emails and said, delete. And Carol said, was, you know, like, she was interested in the science, and I just happened, on a lark, I just happened to contact her and say, you know, all the things you wrote about Inside Unseen, you realize there's a way to prove if you have an alien hybrid. And basically she said, really? Could you tell me more? And that started this long dialogue, which led me to Paratopia, of all things. And then it just exploded.
I like the way that, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, really honestly, I was listening to Paratopia out of curiosity about paranormal and trying to learn more about that, because the UFO Hunters led me into a lot of kind of new territory. And
what do you mean? You got interested in the show, or were you on the show? I'm confused.
I got interested in it.
Oh, okay.
So I had listened to it for a long time and had no idea who anyone was, you know, out there. I didn't know what Carol Rainey's connection was to Bud Hopkins.
Oh, nice. You came in almost like with a vacuum.
Yeah, exactly. And just contacted her because she'd written the book, and I said, hey, that's very interesting stuff, and oh, by the way. And so she, I didn't know that she was already talking to Jeff and Jeremy about a Paratopia appearance. And so she said, well, why don't you just write something up and send it to Jeremy and Jeff and see if they would be interested in putting it on their website or publishing it or something. And I said, okay. And it took off from there. So,
nice.
Yeah, and then it was really, really got interesting. So,
well, let's. How so, though? At that point, did people start, like, they were. At first, they ignored you, and then they ridicule you and were like, get out, man. Get out. Get out of this UFO thing. We're all set. We're all set with you, Tyler. Get out.
If I got any reaction, I guess the way to put it was typically nothing. And very, very few investigators, even the ones. And I'm not kidding you, Tim, the ones oftentimes who really say, oh, what a shame, if only scientists would help. You get on the email or the phone and say, hey, I'll help. And if you want to see them convert into a mummy, that's the fastest way to do it. But there are, fortunately, there are a lot of people who really do both talk the talk and walk the real walk. So I've just kind of been searching for them. But, no, most people really don't have anything to say to me, and that's fine. That's perfectly acceptable. They don't have to. Through the miracle of the internet, I can get my point out there. And you know, I'm talking to people on Paratopia and other venues has been very, very helpful. At least having other sides of the story for people who are searching. And that's all I wanted to do, was to just let people know who've had experiences that science does not necessarily say you didn't see what you saw. That there are people out there who are interested in the stories and are interested in trying to figure out what's going on, and not necessarily going to ridicule anybody, you know, or make light of the situation that we really would like to investigate.
Right.
And,
right.
So anyway, it's been quite a long odyssey. But no, most people, most of the investigators have kind of been, I guess you'd say, cold or neutral.
Yeah. I'd say it's disappointing, but it's also predictable, I guess. You know.
I guess. Now, you have to understand, if you want to look at the converse, if you think about some people, they don't know who I am. They see at the bottom of my email, PhD, he's an academician. They could, for all really good reasons, think, oh, this guy is some kind of rabid debunker, and he's going to take data and kill me with it. So I don't want to talk to him. And but I found some people like Ted Phillips, Frank Fascino, they will work with anyone they think can help them. And they're interested in just getting to the goal of finding out what the heck is going on. So there are people who are fearless. And I understand the others who, you know, not knowing me, maybe would prefer not to work with me. And that's normal human nature.
Well, let's hope that changes, because we, you know, you've heard me crying out for more real scientists to get involved in all this. I've been kind of on a kick lately. We need to really get back to the bare bones of this, just try to figure out what, you know, as far as UFOs go or any of this stuff, you know, get back to the very simplest of questions.
Yeah, I think that's it's really called for. I can't remember the last time I was talking to someone about the idea of ufology must die, but I think that's what some people who are saying that that's what they're really asking is, look, come on, we need to really kind of sort out the wheat from the chaff here and get down to the fundamentals. And I think it's obvious that there are some issues, and there's not a lot of data, hard data for the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And what does that mean, and where are we?
There's not a lot of data for any of these, I guess. What do you think is the good data, and what do you think is the bad? How would we actually go about this, revisiting the big question? You know, I've been kind of thinking about this lately, but, you know, what is the, maybe collecting all the sighting reports and somehow running through some kind of, like, Nate Silver-esque data thing to figure out if there's any ultimate connection between all this?
Well, you know, that's actually, I think, the perfect question. And I think it's a very fair one. Yeah, you come back to somebody and say, okay, how would you do it? And, you know, what are your ideas? And what I would say is, yeah, you could go ahead and continue to collect reports and hope for something good. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, all it takes is one. All it takes is one solid one. So the MUFON STAR team, these guys are ready to go out there and pounce. Sounds like a great idea to me. I just wouldn't make that necessarily my only thing. And in terms of what are the central things to look for? The first thing I'd say is if you can hone down what you're doing into specific, hopefully testable or observable hypotheses. So, talking about, you know, what would the visitors be like? Would they be mechanical devices, or would they actually have actual, really biological entities on them? Which then might help us explain better how they can do the things that we think they can do, or people claim that they see them do. So if you're thinking about, remember Jacques Vallée?
Of course.
And his work, over 20 years ago, he was really pointing the way. And that is, look, you know, put a number to this. How many lumens do you think this thing is? And how does it compare to the other sightings? You know, put it to it, try to figure out what the luminosity is next to a known terrestrial source at a known distance. Let's get some numbers so we can say that what we saw on day one was similar to or grossly different than something we saw on day 57. I mean, look at all the diversity of the shapes and forms and things that we have. What does that mean? The first thing you do is start to do what Vallée said. Characterize, catalog, you know, compare back and forth. And I think he's right that we've done very little in terms of really trying to characterize what are the emission spectra of these things. We see visible light. What else are they doing? And now we have better technology than ever to get after some of these questions. I mean, I think in one sense, it's a great time to be a ufologist.
Right, but you need someone out there with the equipment to do that. Yeah. Ostensibly. I mean, some guy who sees a UFO out in the field, you know, or driving to work or whatever, you know.
Yes.
They wouldn't know a lumen from a lemon.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
You can use that if you want.
I will. You'll see that come back on one of my videos one day. I like that idea. It's true. Okay, and you're right. It could have been and should have been. All these things are only possibilities. And you're right. This is not something that you're going to go out into your backyard and necessarily do on a lark. And so what I would say then is one thing that people have forgotten about, although actually did come up in the UFO hunters, was let's focus on hot spots. And there are some. Arizona has a couple, interestingly enough, or repeated hot spots. Those might be places where people could be prepared and somebody could show up or spend considerable time in theater, so to speak.
Right.
With decent
camp
equipment.
Out for like, you know, have it set up for a long period of time. Like
yeah, yeah. I think, you know, you're right. This is a frustrating phenomenon. And in one sense, the closest thing that I can come up with when people ask me, like, well, what are you dealing with? It's truly ephemeral. And the closest thing that most of us are familiar with maybe is mirages. And if you go out there and you've seen one, you know, like the water on the road thing.
Yeah.
You see it. You see reflections in it. It's as real can be. To your eye and your perception, you run up there and there's nothing there, but you saw it. I mean, it's that I know what I saw moment. And we can ultimately now, understanding a little bit about physics and how things, including light rays, work, have an explanation. And perhaps with enough luck and enough hard work, we'll be able to figure out, like, maybe some of the things we see have perfectly prosaic explanations and maybe they don't. Right now, they're really hard to explain. And which makes them fun to me.
Yeah, I think that's why, you know, I kind of made note of that when you were telling me about your background, because it struck a chord with me, and I'm sure a lot of these listeners. There's a very voracious quality about this subject where I can't think of too many people I haven't talked to where as soon as you pick it up, you just get really invested in. There's something very, you know, sticks with you.
Yes. Yeah, it begins to obsess you. And you sort of, it's like dog with a bone. It's like, whoa, gosh, this is an interesting problem. So I like to return to it in the time that I have because I have other responsibilities. But I find that it's never dull to come back and return to it and see what's kind of going on and messing around and trying to solve a really, really challenging problem. And so that's the kind of the basis of fun science, you want to think of it that way. It can be frustrating, but, you know, if you kind of enjoy the chase, you find that you have a lot of fun just being out there.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Well, the ETH thing, you know, we exchanged, like, emails here before the program, so I've got a few of your thoughts here. And you say, you know, the state of the ETH is dismal. And I just feel like that's kind of... I feel like ufology has jumped to the conclusion before, without actually going through all the steps to get to that conclusion. So,
ETH is the explanation. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, you know, it's
yeah.
Like the line of thinking never really crossed the barrier of proving it, but somehow along the way it just became accepted just to far too many people. You know, and that it's in the mainstream as well. Do you know what I mean? That synonyms. You know, synonymity, if that's even a word,
yeah.
Of UFOs and ETs. You know, we need to break away from that whole thing and be like, listen, we just don't know what they are. They're just these lights right now. Let's stay away from a lot of the other stuff.
And some of the people, I think Richard Haynes, NARCAP, and others are trying to establish that idea and have for quite a while. But, yeah, if you look back at a person, very high-profile person like Stanton Friedman, will come back and say, I've gone through and I've looked at the evidence and the only thing that kind of explains it could be this. Well, that's kind of an explanation by failure to explain. And that's one of the better, more thoughtful ways of getting to the ETH. In one sense, I see it, but in the other sense, you're exactly right. This is cart before the horse. You know, you're way down there, and that can mislead you. That can mislead you so badly. Confirmation bias is deadly. And I think that That's one of the things that scientists constantly have to watch out for, is becoming too enamored of our own theories and then ignoring critical bits of data that don't fit, but would maybe help you come up with a slightly different view of it. So yeah, I think the other thing is, from a scientist's perspective, is that the ETH proponents have so little in hand. And I think at the UFO Congress I heard, you know, oh gosh, it's 70 years now almost after Roswell, and where are we? We're at the same point. You know, we're just arguing more in depth about basically the same historic cases. We're just not getting anywhere, and it's not very satisfactory. And in terms of attracting scientists into the field, I'm going to tell you that you won't have many, not professional people, because there's nothing to grab onto. You want to think about it, the fastest way to kill your career would be to say, oh, I'm going to study UFOs. You remember the curse of Phil Klass and the idea that you won't know anything more than you at the beginning. What you know at the beginning will be the same amount you know at the end, which will be nothing. And I mean, very, very negative idea. That would be fatal. If you're attempting to get tenure or support or whatnot, there's just nothing to grab onto. And it's not like doing cancer research, for example, you know, where you can study it in the lab and you can really work with stuff. This is really hard.
Well, let me just... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it just makes people shy away.
Well, that's what I wanted to touch on, because I agree with you, but I've talked to people that really vehemently are skeptical of the whole idea that there's this academic backlash, you know, that people who are trying to make it in academia and science, you know, don't touch the UFO thing. Like you said, could kill your career. I guess speak a little more to that the accuracy of that.
Well, it would be not so much that somebody's saying, oh, okay, UFOs are forbidden. You're not allowed.
Right, right. It's like an institutionalized thing.
Exactly. I don't believe that's the case at all. But I can tell you that if you want to get tenure at a research university, you have to go out and get grants and contracts to support your research, and you have to have publications in the peer-reviewed literature. And what that means is that you have to generate data. It's very difficult to do that with UFOs, and comparatively far easier if you're studying something like I do, Alzheimer's disease.
Right, where you can get blood from a patient.
You got it. And something that I can go out and get, reproduce, I know where it is. I can go in my grant and say, I will have 27 patients. They will fall within these parameters. I will study them for X number of days. Impossible with the UFO situation and other paranormal. So you're just stuck. And so it's so hard to generate data that really, if you want to survive, you know what to do, and that is not go that direction.
Mm.
So I think probably the people that would have the most likelihood of having something that they could do or hang their head on would be psychologists, who kind of study maybe the reaction or phenomenon as a whole.
Yeah, or sociology and that kind of thing.
Exactly. But in terms of the hard science type of stuff I do, no, it's just not going to be very attractive. And so it's not a conspiracy in the sense that they're telling you, like the Condon Report, if you've ever read that.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you revisited that, because you said
it changed
your mind.
Oh, my God, yeah. And it's outrageous. I mean, what was in there, as a scientist, it is totally contrary to what I would hold dear as an academician, in that one of the things that Edward Condon maintained, and he was a very well-respected physicist, but he basically came out and said, there's nothing to see here, this will not generate anything new, and teachers, dissuade your students from being interested. Don't even let them look at this stuff. That was remarkable. I've never seen anything like that. As a teacher, if I had a student who was interested, I'd say, this is a great chance for this guy to learn all about how difficult measurements are, all about astronomy, physics, whatever. I mean, everything, every science you can think of comes to bear here.
So it's a teachable moment, as they say.
It really is. It really is. So, anyway, I don't know. It's
Well, that's remarkable, because I never really sort of looked at it from that perspective, but it's almost like It's almost like you want to give ufology a hug and be like, it's not your fault. You just can't come up with any data. You know?
I like that idea, too.
You know, I feel bad now for them. All this time I've been picking on them, but it turns out, you know, they just can't get anything that anyone can actually use to solve this thing. As sad as that all sounds.
Well, but
that seems to be the case.
Yeah, to this point, we don't have anything really solid. And there is a level at which you would come back. You probably heard of the admonishment about Occam's razor. And what Occam really, what people forget is that his real message was, don't multiply your hypotheses. Not necessarily that the simplest one is it. Don't multiply them. And so if you're not getting, if that compass isn't pointing the direction you want it to point, we come up with another hypothesis that explains, and a second hypothesis that explains the explanation. What we're really doing is not making hypotheses, we're making excuses. It's so easy to do. This is the confirmation bias thing again. And so we've got this square peg in a round hole, and we just keep whacking it harder. And so at some point in science, one of the things that you have to do is step back and say, this ain't working. We need plan B. And that's where I'd say the state of the ETH in my mind, in some quarters, is pretty dismal because we're continuing just the same idea that tomorrow the stuff that didn't work will work. Maybe it will, but maybe it's time for some new visions. And I think that's maybe what I'm starting to hear people start to kick around. And one of the things I was thinking that they're saying when ufology must die is that we really need some new ideas to look at. Let's try to generate those.
Like new ideas as in what, though?
Well, what would be causing this? You know, is it something that, I'm looking at it, and there are a lot of sightings that when you get to them, they are not easily dismissed. Okay, we can have the prosaic ones, and I've seen them. I've gone out, people know what I'm interested, so they ask what's this or what's that. So I have literally seen weather balloons, the planet Venus, a hoax in just the last 3 years here in Phoenix. all of those. So we can get rid of the simple ones pretty easily. But then there are some that are really hard. And the classic thing of it's one guy in Pascagoula, Mississippi, who's maybe had a little bit too much to drink, who sees something. No, these are people who are rational. And a lot of times there are many eyeballs on the same object, and they're saying roughly the same thing. So I don't believe that, you know, it's one person's mistaken perception or whatever. It's more complex than that. So the question would be, is this some kind of natural phenomenon? Now, remember Phil Klass? He was like ball lightning, I think, was his favorite thing, or plasmas. And I think one time J. Allen Hynek talked about swamp gas.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea, you know, and that really backfired on him. That was very unfortunate. But
poor choice of words.
Very poor. Very poor. never live that one down. But the idea of alternate explanations, natural or unnatural, but alternate explanations and means to investigate, desperately needed, really desperately needed.
But you're not talking about like time travelers or people living inside the Earth or stuff like that.
Because
exchanging sort of emails about the speculation aspect of ufology, and I think, as you've said to me, it still goes back to the ETH. So this whole idea, I think you're saying is, you know, maybe take the idea of an intelligence out of it.
This is hard. It's hard even to put into words. And trust me, I've gone over this myself quite a few times as to what I think, what would be the way to really get some insight into this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the first thing I'd say is I look at the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis of Mac Toney's, and then other things like Micah Hanks put out that I feel are really just modifications of that crypto-terrestrial hypothesis, and they do solve a couple of problems, but in essence, they really are the ETH. We're just saying that they're homegrown. The other thing is you talk about time travelers and advanced technologies. But again, that's what in science we would call the hand-waving part, the magic part. we don't have a good feel for how that might happen, which doesn't mean it can't, but in terms of a mechanism, it doesn't give me much to go on. And so I personally kind of shy away from those because I can't understand them and I can do precious little to investigate them. That's different from saying I know they're wrong, because I can't say that.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, and it's like part of it is if they're time travelers or crypto-terrestrials, I don't know how we could ever really prove that they're coming from inside the Earth or from outside of time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was having a conversation with a previous guest, and it's like, let's say these things show up. We can't believe anything they say anyway. You know, why if they showed up and they're like, yeah, we're from the distant future, I mean, you know, we're just going to take their word for it.
Yeah, assuming that they look just like us.
Right, so you'll never be able to really prove that they came from our distant past, ever. I don't think you'll ever be able to prove it somehow.
Yeah, they would. they'd have to give us something to go on. And one of those things could be, let's get very fanciful now. And let's say that we did have a visitor that made themselves known. Or somebody plugged one and drug it back, okay, and we got it for real. Now, by the way, this is something I'm very nervous about with Bigfoot and all the stuff that somebody's going to hoax it and they're going to catch a bullet. But anyway, I hope that doesn't happen.
I think that's already happened at least once.
Well, one guy got hit by a car, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, please don't hoax this, everybody. But anyway, the thing is that if you got one, you could then interrogate basically what their structure is. If they looked exactly like us, the easiest, simplest, and most understandable explanation is, in fact, they are us. There would have to be some other technological device or something they had that made it clearly obvious that this was wrong, for example. But if somebody came back and said, oh, yeah, hey, guess what? Take a blood sample and do the DNA sequence, and what you will find on chromosome 11 is not what you expect to find, but a little DNA sequence that said made in the USA. You know, and here's where it will be. And ain't nobody on this planet's got that right now. And that would be, whoa, okay, that's interesting. So you would have an engineered species right there, right in front of you. And we could do that. That we could figure out.
Is this the stuff about the people who are immunized? They have it on them all the time? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, it would be kind of a similar idea, is that if this person came from the future and they have gene modifications to the chromosomal sequences have been modified to do something for some purpose, make them smarter, taller, more athletic, something along those lines.
Yeah.
And they could report to us, oh, by the way, I have a completely unnatural modification. It's never been seen in any of your studies so far because it didn't exist until we put this particular sequence in here. That would be verifiable. And so even if they looked remarkably like us, we could tease that out. This was actually where Bud Hopkins was going with his book, Carol Rainey and Bud Hopkins, with Sight Unseen. And they had some very good insights in that book, scientifically. One of the things he was talking about, transgenic animals, and I'm going to tell you, they do, in fact, these transgenic mice that we work with, they look exactly like any other mouse. But in their brains, we've fixed them so they load up with amyloid, the stuff that accumulates in Alzheimer's disease. So biochemically, night and day. And we can find them easily. And that's what I told Carol Rainey. You have a transgenic person? You tell me where it is. It's a matter of minutes, and we'll know, literally, under the right circumstances.
See, that raises, you know, where are all these transgenic people? You know, you hear a lot of theories that there's hybrids and stuff like that out there. You know, as we were talking about this, it's, you know, I've likened the human race, if this is all happening in the way some people think it unfolds, you know, we're just like cattle or something like that, but... You know, even in in the last 70 years, a cow's probably killed a human somehow. Kicked him in the head or something, you know?
Yes.
A dog's attacked a person, you know? People, how can we never get one over on this intelligence?
Or, why haven't they had an accident? A mishap? you know, something go wrong, Apollo 13, and whoop, there they are.
Right, or at least, you know, if we just leave the Roswell thing out, how about, like, yeah, the last, since then, they got really better at it?
I don't think so. I mean, those are the things that lead one to say, my gosh, you know, we really have to think about alternatives.
Hmm.
But, yeah, the thing with alien hybrids and all, that idea, to me, is easy to prove or disprove using DNA technology. And, in fact, I think I was telling Carol that one of the things that I felt that some of the proponents didn't realize is that the reason that I got into this was I was drawn in by some scandals. And I don't know how those are proceeding now, but I was telling Carol Rainey that it was very interesting that the principal investigators never realized that the scandals were one thing, and they were a threat to them, to their continuing their work. But the real existential threat was people like me coming up and saying, dudes, this is bilge. Okay? I mean, this is bilge in its purest form. You got nothing. And if you had anything, we need to see X, Y, and Z. And they're done. The technology raced around these guys. They didn't know it. They didn't know it had come and sneaked up and actually blown past them to the point where they could prove it. I don't know what
this is the hybrid. This is, you're talking about the hybrid theory
in particular. And so, you know, some of those ideas are untenable. They're scientifically untenable. Or show me the data. One or the other.
That raises an interesting challenge. I'll throw the challenge out there, not to you, I don't know if we have any listeners out there that are self-proclaimed hybrids, but there's plenty of people out there who are. So, you know, if you are a self-proclaimed hybrid, you know, do what Dr. Tyler Cochon says and go get your DNA tested or whatever and become a super millionaire, you know, celebrity overnight because you're an actual hybrid. Or shut up. Well, right? That's the challenge part. you can have amazing riches and be, you know, a superstar, or you can stop calling yourself a hybrid.
We'll just let him go. I actually saw one at the Congress.
What's that?
And, I saw one of these people at the Congress who has been publicly outed. Barbara Lamb had given her name, and she's been interviewed and has made some claims, but I don't want to do those tests. And so it would have to be something that they would do on their own, and I'm not anticipating that's going to happen.
No, I know.
But yeah, it would be 1, 2, 3. Please, go ahead. And then, yeah, we got some real problems if these things are true. But yeah, there's a lot of strange claims. The key thing is that there are ways now to get to them. And so that's what I would say is one of the things you can do with the whole UFO situation all the way to abductions is maybe chip away at it. And if we can do nothing else, Tim, we can eliminate the stuff that just plain doesn't work. And to my mind, the hybrid, the alien hybrid, the nefarious plot against humanity is one of those. Great, let's move on to something else. And that alone would be an advance. And those are the things we failed to do. We just spun our wheels in the mud for too long here.
Exactly, yeah. Got to get back to basics. That's what I've been
saying.
Well,
if that's what you mean, I agree, is that the idea of at least eliminating the non-starter ideas.
Hmm.
And now, what was I guess, feasible 25 years ago, when a lot of these guys were at their prime, is very different than what is feasible today. And that's where I say the technology kind of exploded right underneath them. And they never realized that you can't say these things anymore, because now somebody like me can raise their hand at the meeting and say, well, why don't you just prove that? You know, that's a 2-day job. You know, 3 days if you're slow.
Again, yeah. Makes it sound so simple. I don't know why these people... If I thought I was a hybrid, Tyler, I would be there tomorrow getting my DNA tested. And then I would get an agent, and I would get on the Tonight Show.
Well, you know, there may be hope for you. And so we also kind of talked about this, is that there's a dark side to the DNA revolution. And in addition to what all of us are going to have to contend with in terms of what DNA technology will do to our lives, one of the things that could happen is that if necessary, if the two of us wanted to, we could collude and manufacture a hybrid.
Well, I was going to say, actually, the more I thought about the craziness of it, I'm surprised somebody hasn't somehow come up with a way to, you know, when you talk about this Bigfoot DNA kerfluffle that happened this year and is still kind of unfolding, it's like someone could come out and be like, yeah, I got tested by this guy, and this, unfortunately, a portion of the audience would believe it.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, so what do? Well, you make sure that you meet that need for the audience, right? And I'm not sure what the motivations were for the Bigfoot people. I don't know them, and I'm not working with any of them, and I'm not privy to the data. But, yeah, you have to wonder if one of the things that you could do is a really elaborate hoax. And I think that maybe the Bigfoot people have succumbed to confirmation bias and have looked at DNA data in a very hopeful fashion. But I also think that there's the next generation of sort of problem, if you want to think of it, that we face will be someone who comes into it with malice aforethought and has looked at the data, knows what it means, and knows exactly where to go to produce a really convincing data set. Okay, now, if you think about it, when I, as a scientist, look at data, I don't get the raw sequence reads, for example. I get the gene sequence. Let's just say one gene. And I accept that. And I just take that from my colleagues as, okay, this is what they got, and let's see and check to see that I basically agree with the results. But I do not reproduce the experiment. And it would be extraordinary for me to demand the sample so that I could do it myself. Most of the data, most of the experiments are not repeated. So I'm just looking at GATCs and thousands of them. I could make up anything.
Yeah, let's jump ahead, though. If, let's say someone did do that, wouldn't that be, let's someone say someone faked a Bigfoot DNA sample, wouldn't that be such an extraordinary, goes back to that old thing, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. You say it would be, like, unheard of to ask for the stuff.
Yes.
But if this was Bigfoot, I think someone would, you know, you have to go to unheard of, I think, to, and if they did go to unheard of and got the stuff, the blood or whatever, you know, hair, scat, toenail, would, I guess, well, they wouldn't be able to get it, right? Because it would be hoaxed.
That would they
be,
would,
you know,
well,
or, you know, or, and if they got something, like the blood, I guess, you know, that could be just passable in general, would you be able to figure it out, or would it be that sophisticated?
It would be, with the actual samples, you have a great chance of actually figuring it out, really putting it to rest at that point. And that's your final sort of saving grace, if you want to think of it, is that you could say, well, no, we need corroboration. And that's one of the things that with the Ketchum study was grossly not happening. I mean, I don't know how closely you followed that, but...
Fairly closely, but I'm giving up on following it now.
Well, I mean, I think, and that's called for. I would say that people that won't produce the data, first of all, and secondarily, seem very disinterested in corroborating it with someone that would actually know something, are not worth our time and effort. But anyway, if you go back and you think about, okay, now how can I sort of sniff this out? Corroboration would be your final fallback position, that it would have to fall, samples would have to fall into the hands of someone that you truly trusted who could do this. And that person, I think, before they're going to sign on and do anything, would have to know the full provenance of those samples. I mean, I'm not going to take a big bag of hair. Okay?
Oh, shit, because I was going to mail you some after the interview.
Yeah, and so is everybody else. So, you know, boom, there it is. Okay, that's Bigfoot. I could spend a billion years chasing garbage. And if somebody wanted to, you know, basically frustrate you, they could send you crap samples. Oh yeah, doggone, that's the wrong one. That was bag 21. We should have sent you bag 20.
Oh, God.
You know, play that game for a while, or just be very unwilling to give you anything.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
Well, the other thing is that there's a lot of expense involved. And so at some point, if you're going to do full genomic sequencing, we're talking some serious money. And so, I mean, you need people to really give you some decent support. It's not something that you're going to walk into my lab and say, okay, I want a genomic sequence on this within the next 6 months. Well, I can't just do that. So, I mean, it's...
Right, you can't just be like, hey, listen, stop everything, guys. I got to take care of this bag of hair that somebody sent me.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have that, like, in your basement. You can't do that in your basement, so...
No, I don't. And that's... if you're a real scam artist, you know how the system works. And you know how you can game it for a long time. And so in that time, maybe you go on Kickstarter and collect $500,000 and move to Argentina, you know, before anybody catches up with you. I mean, I don't know what their plans are.
Jeez.
But, yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting things. But
well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the scary part of what you're saying is I actually feel like the possibility of some kind of grand Bigfoot hoax, I guess I see how you're saying you'd scheme it somehow. To make a bunch of money and leave town or whatever, but I think the possibility of someone hoaxing Bigfoot DNA is almost less likely than hoaxing DNA just for nefarious reasons. Like, you know, you know what I mean? You're saying that if somebody could game the system, it's going to end up being like some kind of nutcase serial killer or something like that that, you know, somehow games the system, not someone faking Bigfoot DNA, only because it would be so crazy that we'd have to have the double stamp. You know, we'd have to check this like 6 times before people were accepting of that.
Oh, yeah.
Then we'd get caught in the mess. But, you know, some random criminal doing something really nefarious probably wouldn't have the stringent level of corroboration needed that Bigfoot would require.
Well, the interesting thing to think about is that I think 3 or 4 years ago in the New York Times was published an article by a group in Israel who actually did fake a DNA profile. And they pointed out that it could be used for purposes of framing someone for a crime they didn't do or placing them at a crime scene that, you know, they were nowhere near. It can be done. It can be done. And that's I'm talking physical evidence. That's DNA profile evidence, and they had come up with ways to do that. So, yeah.
Like I said, that's the scary stuff that's probably more likely than some Bigfoot enthusiast figuring out how to do this stuff.
Well, or, yeah, other people. But, yeah, this is the thing I worry about, is that somebody will dry lab it and come up and take a look at the data from Neanderthals. And they're very close human relatives. And the very, very striking thing, this is so tailor-made for a hoax, is that when we go back and look, having to be very careful because it is tricky to figure out which is authentic Neanderthal because the sequences are so old, they're heavily fragmented and mutated. But when we look, they're 99% plus identical. And what that really comes down to is we look at the bone structure, the cranial structure, the teeth even of Neanderthals, and they're very different. And then what that means is that relatively trivial changes in DNA sequences can lead to really interesting changes in the organism. You know, a Neanderthal would probably be able to rip us apart, you know, because they were so much, their muscles were so much heavier.
Hmm.
So strong, and it were the number of changes required to produce an organism like that from our ancestors very minimal. That would suggest if I go in and come up with a sequence, a genome, and I pick and choose very carefully, I can go back and say, oh yeah, but see, these are the hybrids, and they only have to be changed like here, 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 and here in controlling genes, and you've got this whole different beast.
Hmm.
And so I've been waiting for that for a while. And haven't seen it yet.
Oh, God.
And trust me, it'll probably come. And I think there's ways around that. I think there's ways to discover that looking at gene expression patterns or whatnot. Again, though, the major thing would be, well, yeah, you're going to have to show me the body. Yeah, and it's gonna
right,
be somebody
right.
I really trust, you know, the Pope, someone, who would come in there and say, yeah, this is real.
Well, he just left Argentina, so.
Yeah, perfect.
Maybe that was his Kickstarter campaign. The DNA thing, I feel like if anything, it'll be like this. It'll be this quasi-stepping stone. but it'll never be really good enough till you get the actual Bigfoot.
I think so. Yeah. I think, you know.
And you worry about people getting shot. Wait till they. Wait till more, you know, Bigfoot DNA happens. Then there'll be people running around all the time trying to get it.
Well, the thing that was interesting to me about the paper, because I did get a look at the text of the paper. I never got the supplemental data from the Ketchin group. And it was apparent that samples were very abundant and coming from multiple locations across the U.S. and Canada, apparently, if I remember right. And they had some things that the story just falls apart if you then go think about it, because it just doesn't work. And that's where you're right. They have to have a body or something to corroborate, because the hypothesis that they have is just frankly unbelievable, that this new hybrid species survived. But there's nobody out there. 16 different samples, and not one of them had an ancestral Neanderthal mitochondrion in it. They're all human. Please, come on. We're not that stupid. And that's what I would tell people when they ask me, is that I think one of the things that I saw when I read the paper is that people hoping that a lot of other folks who read it wouldn't know the difference and would just take it. And that's where I see Banal of America and what I guess you would call the Banal think tank. Man, this could be critical, where you come in there and say, hold it, wait a minute, guys, here's what you got to have. You know, or try to teach people about how to parse the data, or argue back and forth, pro and con, with people that basically know what the arguments are, back and forth one way or the other, so that other people who maybe aren't up on all the technical aspects can get a comprehensible sort of picture of what's going on. Because lesser-known devices, these guys can tell stories that sound really good. Really good.
Well, I appreciate your hopes for what I can do. You know, I'm trying to build this bridge between the two sort of camps, you know, and come up with ways to figure this stuff out. That's really, you know, the only way we're going to figure it out is we figure out how to figure it out.
Yep.
So that seems to be the problem here.
Well, and I think also I like the idea when you talk to Sharon Hill.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I thought that was a wonderful program.
No, thank you.
I know that you got some heat for that. But what I really liked was the idea of talking to people that you could have, under any circumstances, legitimately just yelled at, you know, for errors and mistakes. Instead, you went back and had a conversation and then began to figure out where you had common ground. And I think, you know, that was brilliant.
Thanks.
Definitely, in my opinion, needed. Now, I know you're probably going to have people who would say, oh, you can't talk to skeptics, you can't work with them. And I would say, you know what you do? Exactly what Tim Banal did. He found the one who was workable, and he worked with her, and it was great. You know, and she came up with the same thing I would tell you. What would you do? Well, I would look for multiple lines of converging evidence for Bigfoot. And, you know, talk about, and so it can be so simple that somebody can come up with an idea when you have a group of people who really will brainstorm. And so that's where I'd say the Banal think tank might be really important, that you could bring people together and say, oh, yeah, by the way, if you have a human DNA sample or a blood sample, check it for a tetanus titer. And, you know, one simple test, because Bigfoot ain't getting a tetanus vaccine.
Yeah.
But if somebody's admixed their own DNA in there, or blood, odds are they'll have a titer if they're from the U.S. or Canada. And it will show up instantly. And it will be end of story for that sample. But, you know, if you have people brainstorming from different perspectives, it can really work well.
Well, that's why I want to have you on the show, actually, to you know, that's why I'm throwing these things at you. Like, how can we actually get to the bottom of this? This is sort of it's less an interview and obviously more of a conversation, sort of like a bull session to figure out where the hell we need to go from here. Because,
yeah.
You know, I want to know the answer before they put me in the ground, that's all.
Well, I'm hoping that we'll at least be able to winnow it down to where we can say, you know, some things work, some things don't work. And one of the things that I would say, and you know, the good news is that I think there's a lot of people out there you're going to be able to work with. But not everybody. Let's just face it. I'll just come out and tell you that in science, we work collaboratively in our group all the time, but we have ended collaborations because people were not workable. They were kind of jerks or whatever. We just didn't get along, and so we just parted ways. It won't be any different when you talk about the camps, skeptic versus believer or whatnot.
Right.
But I think, you know, there's some good people out there. And I would hope that you can be able to maybe bring them to your website or go to theirs, working back and forth, post things, have conversations. I've been able to, do you know Guy Edwards?
It sounds familiar.
Bigfoot Lunch Club.
Okay, yeah.
He's been very open to the idea of, hey, here's how, you know, if I was going to do this guy, this is what I would look for. Or these are the questions I would ask Dr. Ketchum that she's not answering at this point. And so he's been really good about saying, okay, yeah, what would you do, and listening to that. And, you know, there's a couple other people out there, Parascience Journal, George Stadalski, I think, is trying to do things.
Well, we need to, like you said earlier, you know, we need to get rid of these non-starters and situations
as
like this Ketchum thing, you know. It got a lot of hype, it was looked at, it was, you know, it doesn't hold up, and now it's time to move on. That's kind of my take on it, you know.
You know, that's the perfect take, and that is exactly the scientific perspective. Hey, this is a great idea. This is really cool. Let's explore it. Oh, okay, this data is not consistent. Let's try something else. And that's how it goes. Somebody told me the key in science, to succeed in science, is to have a lot of ideas, because most of them don't work. I'm here to tell you it's true. So, yeah, if you can muster that kind of guts to do that, but you can see that this is where confirmation bias and getting wedded to your ideas, or whatever reasons, I don't understand Dr. Ketchum's motivations, but those can interfere.
I'd like to think they come from a place of good intentions, but I just, you know, I don't know enough of really the inside baseball part of it, and I don't think anyone really does.
Well, maybe somebody does. I think.
I'm sure the players know, but
the interview I haven't heard. Maybe you have, and the one I'm very curious to hear is she has that list of co-authors.
Mm-hmm.
Man, how I would love to know what one of the co-authors feels about having their name linked to what I would call a major debacle. How'd that work for you? You know, how much input did you have?
Well, good, you know, that's the kind of thing I think you revisit like in a year or two or five,
yeah.
You know, and in 5 years, see where these people are and see what, you know, then they'll really be willing to talk.
I don't know. Sometimes there's problems with authorship in science. And one of the things that happens with people once they get into the National Academy is that folks want to attach to them. And so a lot of times they sort of adopt your name, put your name on papers that maybe you don't contribute very much to.
Yeah, is that allowed? Like if you and I exchange emails, can I turn around and put it in my paper that as you as one of the authors? Because they don't like directly quote these people. They're just sort of listed as like, you know, contributors almost, right?
It's okay. It's okay, provided. Now, remember, they published the Ketchum thing came out in a very, very peculiar format, not the typical scientific journal.
Right, it's like a homemade journal, if you will.
It really is, as far as I can tell. And that I believe, was to bypass, really evade formal peer review that they weren't succeeding at. And I'll just tell you honestly, Tim, when I saw what was presented to me as the paper that supposedly she published, and I take it as it probably was, it's no wonder that they couldn't get through peer review. I mean, it was just bad. Logic errors, very poorly written, and then Sharon Hill actually, maybe the JREF Foundation, pointed out that there were literature citations in there that were bogus.
Yeah, April Fool's papers and stuff like that.
Yeah, and so, and then the excuses that came out were mind-bogglingly stupid. And you can quote me there, but going back to the idea of how journals function, right now, when you send papers in, all of the authors are notified by the journal that your name is associated with this paper, and you have to approve, and everybody has to say, yes, I was part of this, I agree.
Really, like sign off on it.
Sign off on it completely, and include even now conflict of interest statements, because some of the stuff that we do may have implications for drug or patenting. And so you have to say, look, I'm not paid by a pharmaceutical company or whatever, or if you are, you have to disclose that so that people can say, oh, gee, I wonder if that affects his opinion. But anyway, the full thing is very carefully vetted by the journal. And so I'm going to bet that, you know, none of that applied here, that they just did, she just did, whomever. I don't know who was responsible, whatever they felt like. And you had this veneer of what appeared to be scientific respectability, and I think that they were hoping that nobody would get through the candy coating.
Right.
And you can see what happened when they did.
It's almost like a reverse Condon report.
Yeah, well, except these guys were right. Okay, I'm not sure Condon was necessarily right in everything that he said. And in fact, I don't agree with him, but I have to sit there and say, yeah, I think that they got ripped a new one publicly.
Yeah.
And that was unfortunate. But, you know, I mean, there were a lot of alternatives to this, and one of them would have been not to go through traditional peer review, but to ask people that were highly respected in the field to review it and be able to place their comments.
Well, yeah, I mean, are you following the Brian Sykes stuff? Because that's, you know,
the honest broker. Or I guess he would be the honest broker, but they don't want him or don't like him.
I don't even mean in relation to their stuff. He's doing his own study of Bigfoot DNA.
Yeah.
So, you know, we may get the good stuff eventually, but it may come out of England with his research.
It could be. And my guess would be, again, it's just a guess. And the other thing I should say that we didn't emphasize, and I think you probably agree with me, is that the failures of this particular group, Dr. Ketchum's group, don't tell us anything in reality about whether or not Bigfoot does or does not exist. We can't tell from her data. I think that she has failed to prove the case. What the reality is still open.
Absolutely, yeah.
We just leave it as an open question. And what I don't want to give people the idea is that by debunking one very poor quality scientific study, that we're then saying, and see, all Bigfoot researchers are
wrong or whatever, yeah.
About them. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
It goes no further than Dr. Ketchum. It's one study that was rejected. End of story. But yeah, I think if I had to guess, if you made me fill out the form like the NCAA tournament brackets.
There you go.
Today, I'd say what you're going to hear from Dr. Sykes is I got a lot of dog and human and coyote DNA, but nothing that I would call definitive Bigfoot.
Wow, all right.
I'm just going to guess that's how it'll come out. But you know what? It'd be so cool if it wasn't.
I mean, exactly. That was a disappointed wow, because I'm hoping that because he's a world-renowned sort of researcher, I mean, isn't he?
He is, and an expert in these areas, so that you can be confident that when he's willing to come forward and say, you know what, I think we have something, you should pay attention.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm telling you, I live for that day. I mean, people, a lot of times, I think, don't understand. And again, I saw another skeptic who came back and was writing about the problems of being a skeptic. We love these subjects too. And I wouldn't come back if I wasn't intrinsically fascinated by some of the topics. And so it would be so cool. I mean, I'm going to tell you honestly, if I thought David Jacobs had the answer, I would be cozying up to him, you know, lighting his cigarettes, opening doors for him, everything I could do to be on his paper, because that's the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
If he's right. He's not.
But, sorry, David.
Yeah, so,
if you're listening,
well,
sorry.
News to him.
But, yeah, he's waiting for the invitation to Europe there for the coronation.
And he will continue to wait. That's my prediction.
Let me take you down a whole different path. Because I know you do the research into Alzheimer's. That's your big field, right?
Right.
Okay. Have you, and I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I presume you've heard of this whole thing with lion's mane mushrooms?
No. What is it?
This guy, Paul Stamets.
Okay.
He's done, I guess, lab research that has a remarkable effect for Alzheimer's patients.
Okay.
He's a mushroom expert.
Okay.
And his article on it was at the Huffington Post, so he's no, you know, it's not from the Examiner.
Okay. Yeah, I see him here.
So, yeah, take a look at it if you can.
And he has discovered a miracle magic cure for Alzheimer's?
Not necessarily, but it helps, I guess.
Okay.
I'll let you're the expert. You know.
It turns out that actually I was talking with Jeremy Vaney about this earlier. Lots of people have medicinal approaches to AD, and one of them has been curcumin, the spice, and things that sometimes have lab tests in mice, for example, that show real promise. The problem with the mouse models, is that they don't mimic the human disease very well, and I feel like they've led us astray. But there are certainly Alzheimer's has an environmental component to it that we do not understand. And probably one of those things are diet and environment. And so I wouldn't say offhand that I would say, oh, no, this is absolutely not good. I'd have to look at it very carefully and see what he's talking about in terms of mechanism. But, no, I mean, it's just one of many ideas that are out there.
Yeah. The only, like I said, I'd heard about it recently, so I figured I'd run it by you because I figured it was right in your wheelhouse. I think you'll find it interesting. Take a look at what he has to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's happened to us with Alzheimer's is the field is in a major funk. Okay. I mean, we are at a real problem point, and not unlike ufology, if you want to think about it in that kind of light. We can't tell which way really to go. That we've had some highly hoped for therapies that have failed. And not just, like, they didn't work. They killed the patients.
Wow.
Kind of stuff. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. We're sitting there thinking, like, my gosh, is our basic model correct? And so we have these battles going on right now back and forth. Now, I'll just tell you that I believe that the mainstream idea that this beta amyloid protein that accumulates is problematic. But I don't believe that the cure of Alzheimer's disease is as simple as eliminating these deposits in the brain, that it's going to be a little bit more complex in getting rid of what we call senile plaques and their vascular issues and other things in there that have to be dealt with. But, oh, my God, are we're just spinning around and I think trying everything we can. But, you know, you talk about what kind of got me interested is that thinking of camps, like skeptic and believer,
mm-hmm.
That's a little foreign to me because in science we don't really have that. We're all kind of on the same team.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
We all hate each other. And seriously, we fight each other. Like, you can't believe. There isn't any camp. We don't need one. It's a free-for-all.
Mm.
And so we will do battle all the time. And we don't divide immediately into, okay, I believe this or that so much. But we end up kind of doing that.
Yeah.
But it's interesting where we are and the parallels between ufology, so to speak. So fun stuff to kind of ponder.
Well, have you heard about the whole theories that somehow it's connected to mad cow disease and that kind of thing?
Oh yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
You know what? Part of that I firmly believe. Now let me just clarify.
Okay.
not mad cow disease in the infectious thing, like, okay, you eat hamburger and it gets into you and that then causes the human form, new variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. But the idea of prions, the infectious proteins, and how they transmit themselves by basically converting a bad protein, converts a good protein into a bad protein, and they kind of spread like water freezing. That idea has a lot of cachet amongst my scientific colleagues, and I do think that there is something to that as to how these things, like Alzheimer's amyloid, have certain prion-like properties. And You can think about we can actually transmit the Alzheimer's pathology from animal to animal by taking some of the amyloid and sticking it into a undiseased brain and kind of watching it spread out.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and so that it's not a transmissible sort of disease like the mad cow prions, for example, but it does have a lot of common elements, and that will be something that will be important for us to recognize and control. Now, one of the things that we're doing in our group is we're looking at brain injury, traumatic brain injury, as for like military people who get exposed to IEDs and other damaging events, and trying to figure out the commonalities between the injury response and the ultimate generation of Alzheimer's disease. And we think we're seeing some common aspects there. And so we're trying to get the Defense Department to allow us to study these soldiers a little more carefully as they return. This is, again, it would be a spreading phenomenon.
It's similar to the whole idea of the football players.
It is. It is. In fact, one of the last papers we published just at the end of the year is about a phenomenon called dementia pugilistica, which is in reference to boxers.
Right.
And they end up oftentimes with what appears to be dementia like Alzheimer's, but when you take their brains apart on autopsy, you find that the pathology is quite distinct, and it's a different animal than Alzheimer's, but they end up, biochemically, they end up totally demented. And so our idea, and it's not unique to us, but the idea is that the two pathways, Alzheimer's disease and dementia pugilistica, may have some common aspects. And we might be able to figure out how to stop them early, if you want to think of it that way, by getting back to the core kind of thing that sort of ignites them.
Right. So if you can figure out like what causes the Alzheimer-like symptoms in the football players, you might be able to figure out what causes the Alzheimer's in general.
Yeah, or how it progresses. That's what's getting us now. So when we've gone through and looked at the brains, what we've done is not the standard sort of histology. We're actually doing the biochemistry, and our techniques are immensely sensitive. And we believe that we see that the damage goes further than people had thought that it did, and possibly, although we don't know anything about the actual appearance, may start very, very quickly after one or two instances, which is quite troubling if you have a kid playing football.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Example. So, yeah, so we're really trying to figure out, what does it take? Now, the one thing to keep in mind is that football, dementia pugilistica, those are chronic situations where people get blow after blow after blow.
Right.
The military one is incredibly violent. One shock and done. Mm. And I mean, it's just stunningly hard on these brains. So supersonic waves traveling through the skull and the brain bouncing back and forth. So you can picture that. Pretty god awful.
What would cause a supersonic wave? Like an explosion?
Yes. And more of the, what was really interesting is when we started talking to the military people is that I don't know how your mind works, but mine tends to be dichotomous. Okay. One thing, black or white, yes or no, up or down. And so they talk about IED, it's an explosion, okay? One wave and the brain bounces back and forth. It's called coup and counter coup. And you get damage on both sides. But it turns out these IEDs are often like artillery shells strung together, and they never go synchronously. It's a daisy chain. It says boom, 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 very, very quickly. So one wave has hit, the brain is bouncing back,
wow,
and gets
ricochet
hit by a
like
second.
That.
I mean, it's just horrible. So really, really, there's no good civilian analogs to these things. So we're hoping that if we can figure out, how does the brain manage this incredible onslaught of damage, that one is interesting to us because we know precisely when it occurred. And then from that point on, we could follow all subsequent events with a precise orientation in time. The other ones, sporadic Alzheimer's disease, for example, utterly impossible to time. We just know that somewhere around age 70 or something, this person had problems. The chronic traumatic encephalopathies, long-term blows to the head. So you can see why we got very interested in the military. thing. It could be something where we know exactly what the inception date was and everything that transpired thereafter.
Yeah, you can apply a timeline to it and really
that's what we hope.
Figure stuff out. Now, I've noticed, I've kind of always found this sort of thing interesting. Now, is instances of, beyond the Alzheimer-like symptoms that we're talking about with the soldiers and the pugilist item, are these instances of Alzheimer's growing? Are we seeing more and more people getting this disease? And I guess the question is, you know, can you trace it back in a sense? Because you don't really hear too many stories of ancient times, but I guess they would classify it as something differently. Or maybe people didn't live to 70 back then, so you had less instances of it. But is it something that sort of emerged at some point in history, you think? Or has it been there all along and maybe just now that everybody has a Facebook page, you know, that their uncle has Alzheimer's or something?
No, you're absolutely right. It is, in fact, an emerging problem. And it's what we would call, if you want to think of it, another civilization disease. One of the first ones being polio, believe it or not. Epidemics of polio occurred when we cleaned up the water supply, of all things. I mean, it sounds stupid, but when we prevented people from dying from typhoid fever, we also prevented them from being infected with the polio virus very early in life, which would actually protect you against paralysis. When they got infected later, they got paralyzed. And so we had these huge epidemics of polio appear. Same idea with Alzheimer's. And I think you hit it right on the head. Human longevity has almost doubled since 1900 in the Western countries. And Alzheimer's disease, the sporadic Alzheimer's disease, is a disease primarily of the aged and the elderly. And so if you think about doing everything wrong, we've done that. We've increased our lifespan. We have unlimited quantities of calories. We're all getting fatter. Instead of working out in the fields chopping wood, you know, I mean, the most I do today is I type Twitter messages. So we're sedentary.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've changed our diets. We've changed everything about our lives. And it has caught up with us with Alzheimer's disease. And I'm telling you, the projections to 2050, which is where most of them cease now, are utterly frightening and stunning, that our gross national product will be consumed taking care of AD patients if the rates continue unabated. We've got to find some way to stave this off. And so if it's mushrooms, you know, people are going to look at it, trust me. That will get a fair look. If it's diet and exercise, in fact, on PBS this week, they had a fundraiser, and Deepak Chopra and Rudy Tanzi, a very famous Alzheimer's researcher, were out there trying to teach people how to protect themselves against AD. And one way to do that is to stay active cognitively, in other words, stay engaged, doing stuff, crossword puzzles, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they even have programs, but also eating right, exercising, you know, the things that Grandma said, they're becoming critical, absolutely critical, or we are going to have a disaster coming. So, yes, you are right. We didn't hear about it before because people never lived long enough. And now, man, are we in trouble.
We just didn't, you know, it's like a catch-22.
It is, and, I mean, everything has changed. When I was a kid, McDonald's, we had one McDonald's in our town, and we had to drive across town to go there, and it was a big treat. And so, you know, you got McDonald's, you know, once every 3 months. Okay, now it's on every corner.
Yeah.
And some of these poor kids are, well, they're living off of fast food, and it's not going to work. There's a guy from the University of Chicago who has published some interesting studies about how he predicts the actual typical age at death, the life expectancy. His name is Olshansky.
Yeah.
S.J. Olshansky. He's predicting that our generation will see the first declines in longevity that has been seen basically in historic times, because we're going to have more kids who are obese, have diabetes, and other things that will lead to heart disease and cancer that will kill them earlier.
Is that, you think, just an American thing, or is that going to be a global thing?
It turns out, that's a very good question. It turns out it's global. And as countries sort of develop as we do, their diets change. They eat more red meat, more junk food, or whatever. However you want.
They want to be like America.
Yeah, and the stuff is cheap, and it's engineered to make you want to eat a lot of it. They're tending to kind of follow along.
So
the demographic curve is affecting a lot of countries beyond the U.S. And Europe. So it is not looking good at this stage. It's absolutely frightening. And that's part of the reason that Rudy Tanzi is out there, is that the Alzheimer's Association is seeing the problems, recognizing that nothing in terms of cure is coming online or is even anticipated in the foreseeable future. The only thing we can do is train people to take better care of themselves. I mean, that's where we are. 21st century medicine, do what grandma says. That's the best I got for you.
All right. Well, there's two, you brought up a couple things here. One's in my notes, and the other is something that's concerned me for a while. It kind of goes along with what you're saying here, but something kind of is, I find the ubiquity of hand sanitizer very off-putting. This is turning you into a bit of a Larry David show, but I mean, what do you think that could have a bad effect on us long-term because people are too disinfected all the time?
Well, you know, there's a theory that we are too clean.
Right.
And that has led to a lot of the rise in allergies. And I believe there's something to that. But these are complicated because the human environment is so complex, it's hard to tease everything out. Mm. But some of the triclosan and other things that we put into the antibiotics are environmentally persistent, and they will get out into the environment and possibly create problems. But one thing you have to watch out for, it's the same thing as taking an antibiotic chronically. All you're doing is challenging the microbes and to evolve.
Right.
Okay? The weak ones will die, and the bad boys will take over.
That's what I mean. You think like eventually I just feel like it could have deleterious effects on people in the long run because like you said, something could mutate. You know, we could end up with some kind of awful disease that sprung from all this. But I guess would we ever even know if that was the reason behind it?
Oh yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. I'll go back and tell you honestly. If you study the history of microbiology and antibiotics in particular, what you see is, I guess what we would call the Red Queen hypothesis, the Red Queen of Alice in Wonderland. Here it takes all the running you can do just to stay in one place. You go ahead and provide an antibiotic like penicillin in the 1950s, and you may go ahead and take care of the target, which at that time was a lot of gram-positive bacteria, but someone else will find that environment just fine. Huh. And so you get rid of the gram positives, and here comes the rise of the gram negative rods. And so you change your antibiotics to defeat them, and the next thing you know, you've got a resurgence of now bacteria that have figured out how to defeat the original antibiotics and have exchanged those things. So we have these constant battles of defeating the enemy and having them come up with countermeasures or changing entirely. I mean, it is the toughest situation you can imagine. It's gone on and on. A great example, gonorrhea. And we've had this wonderful, not so wonderful, series of events that when veterans came back to the U.S. In the 1970s, they had brought gonorrhea with them, and they brought the first penicillinase-producing Neisseria gonorrhoeae. And so the old treatment was just a good dose of penicillin, and that was no longer effective. So we changed to tetracycline. And you know the next story is that you keep using that, and what happens? Tetracycline-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea. So we changed to stuff like ciprofloxacin.
Yeah.
And you already know the ending for that one, that eventually they will defeat every drug we use.
Huh.
And so you end up with infections that were easily treatable that constantly evolve to plague you. And so when you have stuff that's transmitted at the rates that gonorrhea are, man, it's really hard to stop. I mean, you've got billions of events And so you can kill 99.99999%. You still have enough bacteria left to repopulate overnight. And this is what I tell the students all the time, is that all it takes is one. And then tomorrow, it's worse than you can imagine, because that one, if the elements, the genetic elements it's got are mobile, will give it to everybody else. And I mean, it's just crazy how they communicate. All this totally unsuspected.
Jeez.
When I started graduate school many years ago, people said, well, don't go into infectious diseases. That's a waste of time, because if you want to get tenure, back to the tenure conversation again,
yeah.
You need something that's going to be positive, and everything has been solved. Antibiotics are going to take care of everything. You know, don't go there, Tyler. That's stupid. You waste your whole career. Well, wrong. They were much tougher than we thought. So, yeah, will we get? Absolutely. All you're doing is challenging them. So whether you're an HIV patient who's taking the highly active antiretroviral therapy to shut down the HIV, those viruses are ultimately going to figure that out, and they're going to defeat that. And this is what we have, is nature is far more clever than we are. So we can hold them off.
Yeah. That's spooky stuff. The other ubiquitous aspect of life today that kind of spooks me out, and since you've looked at, you know, the brain in depth, or at least have certainly more than I have, let's put it that way, is just the proliferation of cell phones, and I'm concerned that sometime down the line it's going to turn out that they're probably bad for you. You know, but everybody has them now. So, you know, are we looking at a potential here where, or I guess the better way to put it was, do you think these things have been vetted well enough, or should there be some pause regarding, you know, overly using these things?
Well, I would think that kind of along the lines that you do, is that as we let them penetrate everywhere and people use them constantly, that rare events that formerly we didn't see may begin to crop up over the population. And I'll just tell you, I don't have any data right now that makes me say, oh my God, put them down.
Right.
At this stage. But stand by. And I'll also say that one of the things that you have to consider is, we have a rule, at our institutions that, kids under 18 are not allowed in radiation use areas. It's basically the federal law. And that's because the younger that they are, the growing kids, are very much more susceptible to radiation than an adult. And today I was walking to the store, and here's some kids, probably 11 years old, in deep conversation on his cell phone.
Right, right. This kid's as young as like 8, you know, or even younger. This kid's like in kindergarten that have cell phones. It's like, wait a minute.
What's wrong with this picture? So I don't know if that's something that's going to come back to bite us. It's something that would concern me. It is, in fact, radiation. It's not the most necessarily the most dangerous form, but the effects, it makes me worry. I wish I was more expert in the area of radiation biology, but if you want to think about it in terms of how drugs are looked at, you know that we test drugs for safety and efficacy, and we have several different tiers, 1, 2, and 3, but the fourth tier is when the real rare events come out, and that's basically when the drug is released. So the level 4 testing will reveal events, adverse events that come out in one person in 10,000. We don't see that until the doctors really begin using this in the general population.
Right, exactly,
and
yeah.
And report backwards.
That's the stuff that comes on in the commercial at the very end where they're like explosive diarrhea and all this other stuff you may have.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, those things are, they're rare, but they can be extremely serious. And they're very, very hard to pick up on. In the kind of studies that we can do practically. I mean, this is just the reality of it.
Hmm.
So when people talk about taking a drug for allergies or whatever, that's safe for most of us, but never for 100% of us. And so that's what I kind of worry about, are these cumulative effects or rare effects that are really hard to quantify and find. And so we really depend on the companies who get adverse events reported to them. What I'm not clear about is anybody necessarily tracking these issues with cell phones. With drugs, for example, the FDA will insist on adverse events reports, and then the companies hopefully comply in good faith. Sometimes they don't, but for the most part they do. I don't know who's looking, you know, who's quantifying these effects, if anybody.
It could turn into like what happened with the cigarette industry.
It could.
You know, if they know anything, they're not going to tell us. That's, I guess, what I'm trying to say. So,
well,
you know, like,
or...
You know, I don't even want to say the names of the companies, but you know.
Yeah, I think you're very kind, because what I would say is the cigarette industry knew and reasonably should have known their products were addictive and dangerous, and they lied. Okay, I mean, they got out there and they lied, and they did everything they could to obfuscate and prevent the real truth from coming out there. It's, in one sense, yes, they said things that were technically true. But, anybody that understood how things actually worked would know that that argument was bogus. And that they were simply trying to mislead the public. And they got away with it for an awful long time.
Yeah.
So I don't see anything quite like that with, drug companies. But there have been some sad, sad stories. So. I don't know if you remember Vioxx and some other anti-inflammatories that had significant side effects that the company chose to ignore.
That's the whole bailiwick about the pharmaceutical industry. That whole thing is just scary in general, because it wasn't like that back, you know, when you were younger.
Well, we didn't have that kind of industry.
That's what I mean. You know, like
yeah.
This industry sort of sprung up, you know, in the last, what, like... We really burst, I guess when they let them start advertising, right? Wasn't that kind of the big watershed moment where things really kind of changed?
It certainly did help. And then we've had, kind of an interesting change of philosophy about what to pursue. You know, I mean, one of the things that you need is not so much a cure, but a treatment. And you know, the antibiotic thing had kind of been thought to be solved. And so you have these companies sort of looking for new niches, and they certainly found them. And there are a lot of problems to be addressed, and they do a lot of good things. But, you know, Viagra and these other guys, sometimes those are invented products that people want that were intended to basically fill niches that nobody even knew existed. And you realize Viagra was an accident. I don't know if you've heard that story.
No, I was going to ask you, like, who could... I don't know how anyone with a straight face could have been doing the research to, you know, to be like, yeah, I'm working on a pill to fucking help people get erections. It's like, how can you look at yourself in the mirror, you know, when there's people that are hurt? So, you know, but that makes sense then if it was an accident.
Well, they were actually looking for, if I recall, things that would increase blood flow. And they began to go ahead and test this in... population, and I think it was intended to be something for cardiac patients, perhaps to increase perfusion. And they went ahead and they did the study, and it didn't work. It didn't give them the endpoint that they desired, which would be, let's just, if I'm right, fewer heart attacks or less angina, something along those lines. But as they went down, they would start to inquire, you know, well, any problems, anything you noticed, you know, headaches. Stomach ache. That's what they were going for. And suddenly, this great revelation. Well, yeah, there was one thing kind of funny. And I think one of our pharmacology instructors said that a lot of the people, the original participants, were insisting that they be given the drugs in perpetuity. So they didn't want the study to end.
Wow.
But it was one of those things that they hadn't thought about it, but they certainly knew what it was when they had it. So they didn't really start looking for it directly. But, you know, that's just, you know, good business. That you recognize,
yeah. I can't fault them for that. I mean, I actually feel better about that now. You know, at least there wasn't someone out there, like, looking for this.
But, yeah, you're right. The aggressive direct-to-consumer marketing so that I can go into my doctor and say, you know what, I want Celebrex or I want this or that. And that's where the doctors also have to be more sophisticated, and they can say, yes, you can have Celebrex provided you don't have sensitivity to sulfa drugs, for example, because if we give it to you, we'll catch fire and die. So, you know, the doctor's got to help save them, and hopefully that happens.
I presume so, right? Or is that...
Yeah. Sometimes strange things can happen.
Yeah, you know, the person just like, yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
Well, no, there's this thing called the Internet.
Yes. Oh, well, people can order it, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other thing. Who would take drugs that they order off the Internet? That's another, I know lots of people do, but, you know, don't. Oh, my God.
Well, if you recall, in 2009, we had the swine flu, or not swine flu, but H1N1 influenza appeared, and it looked pretty nasty. And people were very concerned. The WHO is talking about a huge pandemic, and we didn't know what the human take rate was going to be. Well, we thought it could be a killer flu.
Uh-huh.
It didn't turn out that way. But at around, I think it really became clear in May, we had a problem. By September, we were really in trouble. Around September, you could not buy Tamiflu. Couldn't find it at any price.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
People were buying it on the Internet, and the FDA was going crazy trying to shut down these operations, and about half of them were overseas, so they had no latitude. And they said that the only good thing was that at least some of these companies were just sending sugar pills.
Yeah, I was going to say, just move to Argentina and start selling Tic Tacs.
Yeah, and no, who would know the difference? And the average person probably would not. Then you're out of business, and they can't find you. So, it is a dangerous proposition. And counterfeit drugs, people don't realize, counterfeit drugs have become a very big problem. That when you go to your pharmacist and are trying to buy things, that they have to be very careful to be sure that they've gotten legitimate things through their suppliers. Unbelievable.
That's scary, too. Jeez.
It is, because we're talking about things that people really depend on. And if you remember, in China, they had the melamine scandal in baby food. And they put that in there, that compound in there, to make the product look like it had more protein. And it's toxic. So it became a real problem. And the Chinese actually handled it pretty aggressively. And I think the responsible parties were executed. Yeah, they don't mess with you in China.
Well, good. Good. If they did it on purpose, you know.
They did. Okay. They did. It was.
If it was just some dude like spilled something in the lab, you know, he could do it. He could just off himself. Seppuku, or whatever that's called. I know I would. I'd feel terrible. I'd be like, oh, no.
Yeah, these guys were looking to make a fast buck, and I think they didn't understand how toxic some of these things were. And of course, little kids, babies, are not able to take much in terms of toxicants. So it didn't work very well for anybody, unfortunately.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon. Tony, today is Alien Abduction Day. You ever been snatched by aliens?
I'm Tony Kornheiser once. Being probed kind of tickles a little bit.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What were they using, a feather duster?
No. Some of them had claws, Some of them had those things that you use to put the logs on the fire. As you can imagine, they all came from Uranus.
Yeah, all right. We don't need that.
It's a joke we can make all the time.
Stay away from that.